From Canada Land, this is The Imposter. I'm Aaliyah Pabani. On this episode...
Every review always writes about me like I'm new to whatever I'm doing.
And that was one where I was like, we are not cutting this edge.
Guy Fieri is just you when you're drunk.
So what's particular about the Baroness Von Sketch Show?
What is particular about it? How do you mean?
Well, tell me about it.
I mean, the core cast, we're the writers, creators, executive producers. So the four of us, Meredith McNeil, me, Jen Whalen, and Aurora Brown, are the main actors in it. And then we have some sort of a company of people that we're slowly building. I mean, we've only had season one, right?
So the first episode starts with this Summit of Nations in Copenhagen. Uh-huh. There's like dramatic lighting, like yes. Almost like Doctor Strangelove-esque.
Yeah.
So it's set in a future where all the leaders of the continent nations
yes.
are women.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming today. This is our first world summit since the revolution where we ascended to power, replacing our male counterparts.
First of all, the economy.
We're cool.
Us too.
Same here, Jill.
Yep. All good here. And what about conflict?
No, we just talk it out these days.
And the meeting ends up being 5 minutes long because
yes.
the women are so self-aware and good at communicating that they solve all their conflicts very easily.
Basically, yeah, that they're not necessarily motivated by war. They're like, they're looking to actually implement social justice. They're
yeah.
actually looking to make, you know, environmental measures that work for the planet. And so because they're sort of unified in that, it's like, any problems with your country? Nope. Everything good
no,
there? Anybody?
No. We just realized we were actually mad at ourselves.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it was fine.
We slept on it, talked about it the next day.
Is that what it's like to actually make the show?
Yeah, sometimes actually we do, you know, reach a point where we don't know how to move forward with the scene or something. We're like, let's go home and sleep on it. We'll come back and we'll see if we feel the same way in the morning. And yeah, so actually at times it is like that.
Okay.
Yeah, we get along well.
So I know that at The Onion, they have just like a room full of comics and everybody has to come into this pitch meeting with 12 headlines. So they go through something like 600 headlines for what ends up being like 16.
Great.
But I guess I was just curious as to what your process is like when you're...
Yeah, everyone pitches Monday morning. So we come in, we shoot the shit, and then it's like, what are the things that you've noticed or you want to satirize or a point of view? Even if you don't know what the sketch is, what is it that really bugs you or what's something that, you know, you want to look at or find kind of funny? You don't have to know the whole scene. You just have like a sense. You're like, oh, there's something about, you know, going up to the cottage and people do whatever they want for some reason. They're suddenly smoking doobies when they don't in real life. They're suddenly like fucking guacamole when they don't, you know, at home. And then as the week goes on, we do readings where you cast it and we do table reads, and some of the things tank, some of the things fly. So if they're doing really well, we're like, great, we got that one. And other ones, we're like, okay, here's some notes, take it off, rewrite it. And some things have like 12 edits on them, like versions. And if you really love it, you just keep working at it. Sometimes though, if you work too hard, it's a sign that the sketch isn't really working.
Right.
But other times, you know, things are sort of revived from the dead.
Do you remember a sketch being like the funny sketch that everyone was just doubled over every time at every stage?
One that makes me laugh every time is a book club. It's just the four of us. And that one almost got cut. We were running out of time. And it was like there was 5 minutes left. We were at the CBC building on one of our last days. And it And that was one where I was like, we are not cutting this sketch. Like, and so we sat down. There was no fancy blocking, no fancy camera shots. In fact, Aurora and Meredith are both in profile, but just happened to have these amazing hairstyles that day that really suited the sketch for some reason. And it makes me giggle every single time.
Yeah.
So that one, and it's four women who are talking about a book club and haven't read the book, but are so earnest about not having read it. And, you know, how'd you like the book? Oh, I liked it on Facebook and Instagram, you know? Yeah, like,
yeah. And yeah. It's called what, like, I Barista?
I Barista is the name of the book. Yeah, I Barista.
So I guess another thing that I noticed, you don't create characters that come back in segments, but, you know, there are some threads that run through certain actors' characters. So,
yes.
For instance, Meredith often plays a character who's uncomfortable, specifically uncomfortable with her own body or nudity. So why did you decide to make it less about developing characters and more about developing situations and scenes?
I think that was part of the early talks of the show where we weren't looking to make an SNL or, you know, with all due respect, of course, to the great character shows that are out there. For us, it was observational. We wanted it to be relatable and satirical, and that the observation and the relatability and the truth of the character, like the emotional truth of the characters, came first before, you know, their crazy name or their some crazy hairdo or whatever. So we knew we didn't want crazy hair, makeup, and costumes, even though sometimes we have, you know, like in Dry Shampoo, for example. But that serves the truth of the scene. So we're always trying to play the truth.
You're laughing at that type, but you're also seeing yourself in it.
That's what
extent.
We wanted. We so wanted us people to watch it and go, oh my God, that's me, or that's my mother, that's my sister, or that's my friend, or oh my, I've been that person. I hate that person. I hate that about myself. Mm-hmm. People have said I have a coterie of villains, and my people are just kind of just bad people sometimes, but just they're not villainesses, they're just everyday kind of jerks,
yeah.
Sometimes and
the
so
boss.
I have some of those, the bosses, mm-hmm. You know, who are a little, but yet they also have a vulnerable side and you kind of feel for them. But some reprehensible people, like the woman in the flippers scene at the pool, who's like, why are you wearing flippers, and get in the slow lane and take off your flippers, and mm-hmm. And likes to sort of set the record straight. So we have repeated dynamics. She's sort of the same type of person who then says, why are you celebrating your birthday today at work? Your birthday's not till Saturday. Oh, well, it's Friday and we're at work. Well, yeah, but your birthday is not till Saturday, right? So why are we bringing your birthday cake? Just that type of person who exists. And yeah. I like playing those people.
Why is that?
Maybe because I'm not that way, but inside I'm like, why aren't we celebrating your birthday today?
You're thinking about it.
Maybe I am. I don't know. I'm not sure. We'll have to, yeah, I'll have to talk to a therapist about that one. I'm not sure.
I mean, you're also, people are kind of playing people that seem to me similar to themselves. So I'm reminded of the sketch where you're playing a queer person,
yeah.
Meeting your straight friend's straight friends.
Yes.
And they've like never seen a queer person before.
Yes.
And that to me seemed like,
based in truth.
Is this Carolyn?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Like, I think I couldn't say every lesbian or queer person knows what that feels like, but certainly many, many do, where, you know, the straight people who aren't exposed to, maybe for whatever reason, haven't been exposed to queer people, meet one and are like overcompensating and thinking that you want to flirt with them and be with them. And just Aurora and Meredith crack me up in that. They're so funny.
They're so good.
And like that they boycotted the Russian Olympics just for me. And like,
and they're both wearing leopard print
things. And they're just like, I'd be a lesbian, but from the waist up. Like, I've heard that from like friends of mine who are just like, yeah, no, it sounds great, just but from the waist up, like, don't want to do any of it. It's like, okay, thanks.
Yeah.
Like, and that one was written, I collaborated on that with Dawn Whitwell and I think Diane Flax on that one. So yeah, a few queerdos wrote that one.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's important to have actual queer people writing roles for queer people.
Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes I was visiting a couple of queer gals from LA who were Torontonians, came back to visit, and my friend Sorel was like, I love when you play straight middle-aged women who are not queer, like just almost suburban. She's like, it's terrifying. Like, I can believe it. And it just kills me to see you do
it's
that.
It's great.
So, and I love it too, like playing the woman at the cottage. Like, I love playing her.
With
a
really
straight,
great Canadian accent.
Great Canadian.
The
at the cottage.
Yeah. Yeah, it's almost like we're watching you in drag, but you're like playing all these, like, not in drag in the sense that you're playing the opposite gender, but that you're playing, like, the span of genders that exist.
That's how it felt. It feels a little like sometimes when I've had to, you know, dress up in some dress and heels and some of my characters, I feel more in drag sometimes than I do if I'm playing the dude at the pharmacy or whatever.
Right. I think your show really represents queerness in a way that I have not seen, especially in comedic shows. Like, we come from, like, comedy histories where dressing in drag was the joke.
Right.
And also, even contemporarily, like, so I'm thinking of this one episode of Portlandia where they have Carrie Brownstein's gay brother, and she hasn't seen him in a while since he came out, and she's like, oh my God, they're gonna, you know, redecorate our house, and they're gonna, like, help us shop, and maybe they'll, like, have suggestions for that.
Right.
And then they come, and, like, they're messy bros, basically,
sure,
but
yeah.
They're gay.
Yeah.
But the joke there is that, like, I mean, it's funny, but the joke there is that, you know, there's this stereotype of gay people, and look, here's the opposite of that.
Yeah, imagine that.
Yeah, exactly. And it's speaking to a particular, you know, audience.
Yeah.
And also, as a viewer, I can imagine a lot of people are like, oh, I don't have those stereotypes.
Right.
Whereas in your show, I found it really compelling that, like, often the gay character is not the caricature.
No.
It's just...
they just happen to be at
the
cottage.
They just happen to be gay.
Yeah.
And then it's really about how straight people act around gay people,
yes.
Which is really a true thing that happens.
Yeah.
And that could potentially implicate people who do say stuff like, oh, I wish I could be a lesbian.
Yeah. Even, you know, in the cottage scene where Meredith and Aurora play a lesbian couple, it's not about them being lesbians at all yet. Some of the moments are when my husband is sort of, you know, titillated by that or turned on. But
I've only seen it in the movies
type of thing. And that's not the thrust of the scene, but it's a flavor within it. And that's interesting. Yeah, that a few times it is like that. It's
mm-hmm.
sort of looking at more the straight people through the circus or the zoo going, oh, aren't they interesting?
Totally.
And how they get uncomfortable in these situations.
Yeah.
Let's watch them.
What is the thing that you feel is different when it's an actual queer person playing a queer character?
Just sometimes it feels really necessary. Well, why not? Like, come on. There's great, you know, queer actors, and we don't have the budget to always be able to bring on different actors for all the parts that we play. And as actors ourselves, we want to be able to play range, you know, and I like to play straight and someone else wants to play gay. Well, that's fine. If you're a good actor, you should be able to work and not have straight people take all your parts.
Yeah, totally. There's enough gay people out there
to fill the parts.
Yeah. One of the other things I really liked about this show versus some other shows that are about mostly women or written by women is that men are kind of incidental to the show in a really big way.
Yeah.
Like, it seems like you almost go out of your way to not have men in so many scenes unless they're like that guy who's like dating your friend who you fucking hate.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Who's like kind of creepy and like always making like euphemistic comments, or like even in that scene where it's like a kind of captain's room. It's like you think there's a man.
Yeah.
And then it's not a man.
It's not a man. Yeah.
Meredith. Looks like we're gonna have to populate Mars sooner than we thought. Thank God we didn't lose you. The only man.
About that.
Oh. Really psyched to be here though.
Hi. Me and you. Overs to overs.
It's interesting because we're playing most of the roles. Like, if we look at sort of the Bechdel test, you know, like we pass the Bechdel test,
we kill the Bechdel test.
We really do. It's like they're not the object of what we're talking about,
mm-hmm.
you know, though they're around and they're one. And we love the cast of guys who played with us. And, you know, men are wonderful. So there's not about, you know, hating them or whatever. It's just not always about them.
Yeah.
There are
enough scenarios in the world that are not represented.
So many. They've got so much. So, like, here's just a little slice where it's not only about them or even kind of about them.
Right.
But it's funny. We don't think often of the male perspective, right? It's just that's the perspective.
That's the default.
That's the default. So I guess it throws people when it's like, oh, wait, we're leaving the default. Okay, and that muddles
but
things a bit.
But I actually like this.
Yeah, but I like it. And I mean, and we love that. Like, we love all the men who've come up and been like, I love the show. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, of course.
You know, like, I like a lot of your show.
Yeah,
like, we could appreciate each other's art and collaborate together and do amazing stuff. So,
yeah,
it is kind of funny when people flounder for the words. And,
right.
Yeah.
So when I watched the first episode, the scene opened with that Copenhagen World Summit, and there were all these women of various different races around the table with like speaking parts, and it's like not something that you see that often. And I was like, yes, like this is gonna be just like an array of women of like all different kinds, like all involved in the show in equal ways. And the thing is when I went on, I realized that that wasn't as much the case. Mm-hmm. There are limits to our experience, and if we try to always be including everybody, then we might end up tokenizing and having kind of really token characters. And I think that people should write close to their experience. What I'm going to ask you is not why there aren't like more people of color with like main parts. I'm going to ask you what needs to be done so that like young people of color who are funny and doing great work don't have to leave Canada or can get this kind of opportunity before they get to age 40.
Yeah, I agree with everything you're saying. What we do is we are bringing in writers who to give them some experience, different writers, some of them young and older white women, some of them women of color, like amazing, great people who haven't had a chance to be in a writing room yet. You have to get in the door, and then once you have that credit on your resume, then you can work on another show, and then, hey, next thing you know, you got a few shows under your belt, and then you go and you pitch a show that represents your experience.
Yeah.
So all that to say, we want more, and the way we can help is to give experience to people, to get them in that room and see if they have a taste for it, if they really like it. And we're doing our part because we believe that's the world we want to be in. So it's not, it doesn't feel at all like, oh, we have to. It feels really amazing to be given this opportunity and to perhaps give opportunity to other voices and then see them thrive.
So on a lighter note, I was listening to your stand-up comedy.
Oh.
And you had mentioned something that I really identify with is that, you know, you never do Kegels until somebody says the word
show?
Kegels.
That night. I remember that night. It's not actually part of my bit. It was just something that came up in the moment. And I talked about that.
That's something that
It
came
just
up
came up in
the moment.
Like, I truly, I don't have any jokes about it. I don't even remember.
Small talk, Andrew.
Hi, Taylor. And I'm talking to you about Kegels. Was it like the Kegels were like applause in the audience or something?
I don't remember.
I don't remember either.
I just remember being like, yes, somebody who gets me.
Finally.
Yeah. Like, I never realize that there were others out there.
There are.
So, like many of us, Lawrence Trapagale used to think that Guy Fieri was a huge tool. That was until about a week ago when she was in New York City and comedian Shane Torres took the stage and asked the audience a very important question.
What the fuck has Guy Fieri ever done to anyone? My name is Lawrence Trapagale. I am a social news editor for BuzzFeed Canada, and I'm here to speak in defense of Guy Fieri. Everyone's all shitting on this guy for his weird catchphrases and bowling league outfits and love of lowbrow food, but who has he hurt? All he has done is be Guy Fieri without apologizing for it, and that pisses people off. You're not mad at Guy Fieri for wearing flaming shirts and his sunglasses on the back of his head like an idiot. You're mad at him for doing those things without any shame whatsoever. You're mad that he looks like a member of Smash Mouth, a band that peaked in 1999. But doesn't seem to care. You're mad that he can say we're riding the bus to Flavor Town without hating himself. You wish you could live with so little shame. Look, I don't want to grab a beer with the guy. I think it's fucked up that he describes things as gangsta. But isn't it weird that we'd rather celebrate obvious jerks like Jamie Oliver than a guy who's just really big about putting cheese on stuff? Guy Fieri is a person that you are afraid to be. When you watch Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives, you wish you're eating whatever disgusting, greasy shit he just called off the hook. Guy Fieri is just you when you're drunk. You go to the same local greasy spoons that he does. The difference is that you make little ironic sepia tone Instagram posts out of it, but he gives them free advertising to a massive audience. So who's the real asshole?
So if you're a freelancer, invoicing is really hard, but not for the reason you would think. It takes like maybe 5 minutes to write up and send an invoice, but it's what follows that step that can seem kind of like a slow descent into hell. So a month will pass and you'll wonder why you haven't been paid yet. You'll imagine the invoice unopened in their inbox, losing rank to things like flight deals and email newsletters and other people's more current invoices. Then you'll draft a follow-up email that starts something like, "Hi, I just wanted to follow up to make sure you've had a chance to have a look at that invoice I sent about a month ago." FreshBooks knows how agonizing this can be, which is why they have this tracking feature that tells you exactly when a client actually looks at your invoice. And then when they open it, there's this giant green button that says "Pay Now" on it, in case they didn't know that's what they're supposed to be doing. FreshBooks makes dead simple cloud accounting software that's transformed how 5 million freelancers and small business owners deal with their day-to-day paperwork. And you could try it for free. To claim your free 30-day trial, go to freshbooks.com/theimposter and you'll see this box that says, "How'd you hear about us?" where you can write "the imposter" and they'll know exactly where you found out about it. Right here. Take control of your life. Send an invoice with FreshBooks.
My name is Becky Johnson. I've been on Second City main stage for about 8 months now.
Hello, my name is Kirsten Rasmussen, and I've been on Second City main stage for a year and a half.
My name's Lee Cameron, and I also have been on Second City's main stage for a year and a half.
I decided that I wanted to be an actor when I was about 11. Comedy came later because there just weren't as many opportunities outside of comedy for women.
My town didn't really have drama or comedy groups, and then I joined the cheerleading team. It was at the time that Will Ferrell and Sherry O'Terry sketch was very popular, the cheerleaders, and then I was just like, oh, I want to do comedy. And when I got to Montreal, the style was much more Keith Johnstonian inspired things, which are like, be yourself, so I kept on being directed in scenes like, okay, Kirsten, you're a 24-year-old English girl who lives in Montreal, and I was like, that's boring, I want to play a pirate goblin who's has a shit daughter, like, I want to be these gross, awesome, huge things that I know and love. That's where I cut my teeth, being a big old goblin.
Improv was the one thing I was very, very terrified to do, and I did it as a way to like force myself out of a rut. Improv is so helpful in that there are no mistakes, like that idea. Mm-mm. Doing improv helped because then you're like, I know I can make something up and eventually I will figure out where I am and what we're doing.
In high school, there were plays that you could audition for. I can't really sing very well, so the musicals were out, and which left the parts for women being basically rape victims. And in not well-written plays.
So many high school plays about rape.
Yeah,
victims.
High school plays about date rape, and not that there shouldn't be plays about date rape, but these were terrible. And, well, it's true. And beyond which, every woman was trying to audition for these parts, whereas the improv team, it was like, if you were good enough, you got in. There were quotas. I found it really empowering, especially as a young woman, to realize that I could make people laugh. And also, it felt really good to be in charge of my own material at that age. That's something that I think young women aren't given very much. They're told you should talk about anorexia and date rape and all these things in ways that old men have written about. Being able to just do work of your own material is incredibly important, I think. But also to be able to make a big room full of people laugh is extremely empowering, I found, as a young woman.
I think sometimes I notice in this space versus other spaces I've played in the city or other cities that the people are often surprised by the women in the cast being funny or driving the comedic sense in the scene, like more so here than any other place that I've played. Do I get people being like, you're a very funny woman. Wow, like the women in this cast are funny, and they
how
need
do
to
they
like,
do it? How are they capable of
yeah.
this?
How are
do
they so funny?
Unscrew their boobs before the show
and pack them full of balls.
Yeah, and sometimes I even noticed it when like jokes move around in scenes, because that's something that happens here. Like, our writing can be very fluid, so sometimes a joke will pass from a character to a character, and sometimes something that comes out of a man's mouth and comes out of a woman's mouth will be received differently.
So we had this sketch from the last process called Sex Canoe, but the premise premise was like, it was three generations of the family. The women were in a canoe together and the men were on a dock together and they were just talking about sex. And it was sort of around the sex ed curriculum.
Yeah.
And so it was just the three of us talking about sex stuff and the men talking about sex stuff. And this scene, we would try over and over in front of an audience, and the men could say the most disgusting things and the audience would laugh. We'd just say menstruation and everyone would be like,
no, stop. Yeah. Please.
And the entire cast talked about this and everyone was like, we can't do a scene that will be received like this, where the women just get screamed at for saying anything about their bodies.
Yeah.
And the men are congratulated for basically saying that they're jerking off into sodas and whatever horrible, they were saying horrible things.
Kevin showed his like mime dick to his son in like minute one of the scene. And like, I think one time I said clot like near the end of the scene and the audience like nearly booed me. And it was just like, they've been literally like describing the look of their balls.
Yeah, and it's the most hilarious thing to the audience.
Yeah, it wasn't even like sex stuff by the end. It was just disgusting body humor.
And that was funny. And like anything we said about the female body was disgusting.
If we'd both said pubes, if the women said pubes and the men had said pubes, we would have got a grossed out. And they would have
got. That's because you're not supposed to have any.
Yeah, women don't wax all of it anymore. They fell off in the year 2000.
Oh, no. I'm covered in pubes. My whole body.
Anyway, that's an example. And when we were working on that scene, like in rehearsal, we all thought it was funny. We're writing jokes and then took it out in front of an audience and everybody was appalled at the reaction.
Oh, no.
Like the guys
were
just like, what's happening? Why does the audience find the women so gross? For me personally, one of the things that I've always noticed is no matter what I do, if it's comedy or it's theater, every review always writes about me like I'm new to whatever I'm doing. Usually in comedy, or you know her from theater. I'm constantly mythologized as being out of my element, is what I found. Except for here, where people are just like, hey, she's here now.
Yeah. I have dealt with those people in my comedy career, of course. Of course, I've been on stage with like a giant stand-up who wasn't comfortable with the fact that this like little improviser was getting more laughs than he was, and he literally manhandled me and put his hand over my mouth so that I could not do more jokes than him. But that was a long time ago, and I think like the people that I seek to work with are obviously people who are comfortable with gender and comedy. I don't know what it is, but it's like, I think just I do not seek to work with assholes, whether they have vaginas, balls, or both.
Yeah, you know, as someone who's generally like kind of quiet and non-confrontational, you definitely notice that the louder voices get heard. It's important for everyone to know to like leave space for those people who aren't necessarily as loud.
Yeah, and that should not be a requirement for survival. I would never, ever make that the requirement. And I was in companies where there were like 10 people and one woman.
Me too. I was like the token girl in so many of my troops in Rapid Fire Theater. And I remember my very first troupe had three wonderful men in it, but they were all, I was 22, they were 18, and they were so loud. And I would just have to scream all of my lines to be heard.
After Second City, my dream life would be to live in a cave, but also have a TV series. It's hard to be reclusive when you're auditioning for commercials all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Drive into town.
Yeah. I don't have to be famous with an infinity pool, but I would like to be able to wake up and know that I'm going to a job that is fun with people that I think are amazing, and I can get my teeth fixed whenever I want.
Whenever. Change them constantly.
No, just
fangs.
Just fix them up. Just fix them up.
After Second City, I want to be famous with an infinity pool.
Do you want one that cantilevers out over empty space? Because that seems terrifying.
No, that's terrifying. I'd be afraid if I had a pool with, okay, some of those don't have sides, and I'd be like, I'd forget what, like, I'd come up and just be like, ugh, and just like try to push myself up on the side of the pool and fall like 25 stories. So that's not my goal.
yeah. Glad your goal's not falling off a building. Out of a pool.
Yeah. The one thing that's not my goal.
Problem is they so close-minded, looking for a big break, still can't find it. Working so hard, they grinding, working two jobs, they 9 to 5. Round of applause when I come through. Sound the alarm when I stun on you. Wherever you go, can I come too? Let's take this on the road, rewind, undo. Rewind, undo. Rewind, undo. Rewind, undo. Rewind, undo. Rewind, undo. Undo, 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 undo,
you gotta work for that. Ain't no problem, cut a slack, your homie, bring it back. So homie, bring it back. Ain't no problem, cut a slack, your homie, bring it back.
I have to admit that when I first started reading this book, I really didn't know what I was reading. Am I reading a memoir? Is this a self-help book? I wasn't sure. Some of the short stories really didn't make sense. Be warned, this book involves a handful of gross mentionings, some profanity, and a ton of sarcasm. Trying Way Too Hard. Wow, totally had opposite reaction to this book, which came off as juvenile and try hard. Ghosting as the right way to leave a party? Not how I was raised. So incredibly rude and selfish, as is what a lot of she discusses in her, quote, book.
That was Monica Heise reading bad reviews of her book, I Can't Believe It's Not Better. Before that, you heard from Lee Cameron, Becky Johnson, and Kirsten Rasmussen, who would rather be a pirate goblin with a shit daughter. Lauren Strapagale, who's now on the bus to Flavortown. And Carolyn Taylor, who just wants to set the record straight. The songs on this episode were Bull and Eagle by Look Vibrant, Hello by Jaunt, and Rewind Undo by Keisha Fresh. If you want to know more about anyone you heard on this show, you can find all of that at canolandshow.com/imp. This episode of The Imposter was produced by Katie Jensen with contributions from Liam Garreau. Original music is by Nathan Burley. We're on Twitter at Impster, I-M-P-S-T-R, and I'm on Twitter at Aaliyah Pabani. I accept pity follows. If you want to tell us what you thought about the show, or about an artist you think that we should know about, or if you have an idea for a freelance piece, email me at Aaliyah@CanadaLandShow.com. Our crowdfunding site is patreon.com/CanadaLand, so if you like what we do, please support us.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.